This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
One of the things that he mentions here is that people who are native speakers feel a proprietary relationship to the Quran. In other words, it's mine alone and nobody else's. Particularly Arabs. Arabs definitely have that feeling that if you don't understand Arabic, you can't really understand the Quran. I personally don't believe that's true. I think that there are Ajami people who don't know Arabic, but are actually more moved by the Quran than many, many Arabs. And I know some people, especially South Asians, who've seen their mothers or their fathers weep profusely reading the Quran, and they don't even know the meanings of the Quran, but they know it's God's words. And that's what's impacting them, is the fact that they're reading a revelation. And that's why there's a famous story of one of the Ajam who heard the Quran and began to weep, and one of the Arabs said to him, "You're a Ajami. And how can you weep by hearing the Quran?" And he said, "My tongue is Ajami, but my heart is Arabi." In other words, the heart can understand things that the mind doesn't necessarily understand. And this is important also. A general rule is that a person with no grounding in the Islamic worldview, if they pick up a translation of the Quran, will have their prejudices confirmed. And I think that, unfortunately, that is very true. That if you go to the Quran already with prejudices, you will find exactly what you're looking for. "I knew it." They do that. See, it's right there in Surah At-Tawbah. "Kill the polytheist word." See, they were looking for that, and so they find it. And when you're looking for something, you're often blinded to the other things. So prejudices can be confirmed in the Quran if you don't allow the Quran to speak to you without... And that's why the Quran begins, "ذَلِكَ الْكِتَابُ لَا رَيْبَ فِيهِ هُدًى لِلْمُتَّقِينَ." This is guidance for people that already have piety. And it says this is a book, there's no doubt in it. It already declares its position right from the start. If you have doubt about this book, it's not going to benefit you. Now, not being open, it doesn't necessarily mean you have doubt. See, if you believe automatically it's not a revelation from God, then you're going to read it with that perspective. If, however, you go to it and say, "I want to find out, is this a revelation from God?" It's not that you have doubt. You don't know anything about it. And you simply want to see for yourself. So going skeptically and going objectively are very different. And you will have very different experiences in taking those routes. Another thing is the Quran and the worldview of the Quran is definitely connected to the Arabic language. The Arabic language is a Semitic language. It's the languages that Moses alayhi salam and Jesus alayhi salam spoke. They spoke Semitic languages. The root structures of Aramaic and Hebrew are very similar to Arabic. Hebrew scholars are forced to use Arabic dictionaries by their own admittance. They are forced to use Arabic dictionaries to interpret the Hebrew language. The reason for that is that the rabbis prohibited putting down a great deal. The Midrash, they have an oral tradition that was not permitted to be put down, and they never bothered to do any dictionaries. The Arabs began to write dictionaries immediately. In literally the 8th century, the first Arabic dictionary, which is already a sophisticated dictionary. Unlike the English language, we find our first dictionary is in the 16th century, and it's a bad dictionary. It's a lousy dictionary. Whereas the Arabs were already writing extremely sophisticated dictionaries by the 100 years of Islam. And another thing about Arabic is it was preserved by poetry. Aisha radiallahu anhu memorized 12,000 lines of poetry from just Labid, one Arab poet, 12,000 lines. And that's not an exaggeration, because I know people that have memorized far more than 12,000 lines, personally. So I know that that's not an exaggeration. On page, unfortunately, 19, there's one expression there that I thought was inappropriate, and you can see it for yourself, but I crossed it out in mine. And I don't want to repeat it. They were using an English idiom, and I don't think they intended anything by it. But I don't believe it's appropriate to say in conjunction with the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. Let me put it this way. The Quran is the miracle of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. Never forget that. The Quran is his miracle. In other words, the Quran is the proof of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. Because he is the first and greatest Muslim. Now the next is the Quran. It has 114 chapters. It is a non-linear book. And that becomes problematic for Western people that are used to a book like Genesis. It begins in the beginning and it goes by history. When you read the Quran, it doesn't begin in the beginning. It begins exactly where Allah wants to begin it. It begins Alif Lam Mim. And nobody knows what that means, which I think is one of the greatest proofs of the Quran. Because I don't think anybody could think of that. To start a book with letters, nobody knows what they mean. To show you, وَمَا أُتِيتُ مِنَ الْعِلْمِ إِلَّا قَلِيلًا, you've only been given a little bit of knowledge. وَفَوْقَ كُلِّ ذِي عِلْمٍ عَلِيمٍ, over everyone who knows something is somebody who knows more. You have to go to the book humbly, because it's already telling you, you don't know everything. In fact, you know very little. So that's important to remember. Now the Prophet ﷺ, on the bottom of page 20 also, it mentions that in some traditions, the Prophet ﷺ contemplated suicide. That is not true. He did not contemplate suicide. He was deeply troubled, which is another proof of his prophecy. Because one of the things about false prophets is they want to convince you that they're sent from God. Whereas the fact that the Prophet, his first response was, what's happening to me? When it was confirmed by his wife and then by Waraqa, the cousin of his wife, at that point, it hit home what was happening. But initially, he was very troubled. And it was a deep shock. And he was not reluctant at first to submit. I mean, there's no, they mentioned that also, reluctant at first. Muhammad submitted to God's will and began to proclaim his mission. He was not reluctant in a true sense of that word. He was troubled and he was also worried about the responsibility. And you can see that in the Quran when it says, don't try to keep up with the revelation, because when it was being revealed to him, he used to try, because he was so worried that he would forget something or that he wouldn't get the whole thing. So he had a deep sense of the debt and the burden of bearing this message. The basic idea, the Prophet ﷺ was born into the Arabian Peninsula. He was born in an environment of idolatry. He disdained idolatry early on. He did not like the idols. He never swore by the idols. He never prostrated to an idol. He had a natural inclination to tawheed or unity of God. And that there was a tradition on the Arabian Peninsula called the Hunafa. Hanif in Arabic means one who naturally inclines to God. And these were people that knew that God was one. They believed they were on the path of Abraham, alayhi salam. They did not follow Jews or Christians, but they believed in this unity of God. And there were several of them, but they really are not many. There were several in the sense you could count them on your fingers, but there were not a great deal of them. And the Prophet ﷺ inclined towards that tradition, but he had no revelation until he was 40, and then he began to have true dreams. And then he began, when he used to go to his mountain, and he did what was called a type of emptying out, tahannun, which means to empty out or to remove any traces of the idolatry of his people. It doesn't mean traces, but rather avoiding or shunning idolatry. So it was this purification work, and that's when the revelation comes. Now, the Arab tribes considered themselves, and we consider and believe that the Arabs are descendants of Ishmael. Ishmael is the son of Ibrahim or Abraham. Ishmael was the firstborn. He was the son of Hagar or Hajar, and he was, according to the Bible, he would sire a great nation. That's what the Torah says. Now, one of the things that Martin Ling says is the Torah is a sacred book, not a profane book. And God will not put great with anything profane. In other words, if God said he will sire a great nation, that means that they would be a great nation in God. Now, another thing is that the official Jewish doctrine, and a lot of people don't know this, but the official Jewish doctrine of some of the greatest Jewish rabbis, including Maimonides, Nehemiades, several of the greatest commentators of the Torah, believe that the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ was a divinely inspired person and that his revelation was from Providence. They actually believe that it was from God. But they believe that it wasn't specifically for them. And they believe that it is a fulfillment of Zechariah's prophecy, which is in the book of Zechariah. And now I'm telling you, this is from, you can read this in books on Jewish theology that aren't influenced by the politics of the Middle East. the Jews believed when Zechariah said the teaching, this pure teaching of what was given to the Jews would spread to the east and to the west. The traditional interpretation of that is it was Christianity which went to the west and Islam which went to the east. And the traditional interpretation was also the Christians were half proselytes. In other words, their understanding was marred because of the Trinity, whereas Muslims had a full understanding of the unity of God, and they were in a better position to prepare the world for the coming of the Messiah, who would bring Tawheed for the entire world. The Jewish position of some of the greatest Jewish rabbis is that Islam is a vehicle of providence, and that it was a way of preparing the world for this coming of the Messiah. Now, obviously, we believe that the Messiah was Isa alayhi salam, Jesus, and so do the Christians. But it's interesting to note that that is a position. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi salam, who is a son of Ishmael, when he was given this message at the age of 40, initially he just spread it secretly, and then at a certain point Allah commanded him to go out and teach it to the people, and he did. The response that the Arabs gave, يَقُولَ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا إِنْ هَذَا إِلَّا أَسَاطِيرُ الْأَوَّلِينَ. Those who disbelieve, they say, these are fables of the old. In other words, these are fairy tales, which is very interesting because it's a very modern thing to say about Revelation. So it's interesting that the Quran dealt with that type of response. One of the things also that they mention, which is in Surah An-Naml 2768, in which it says, لَقَدْ وَعِدْنَا هَذَا نَحْنُ وَأَبَاؤُنَا مِنْ قَبْلُ إِنْ هَذَا إِلَّا أَسَاطِيرُ الْأَوَّلِينَ. We've already been promised this before, us and those who went before us, meaning the Jews and the Christians. These are just fables. So the Arabs, some of the Arabs did not believe this. Now, the turning point for the Prophet ﷺ comes in 622, which is when he makes the hijrah. This is a major turning point for his teaching, because after 13 years of oppression, he makes the hijrah, he goes to Yathrib, he makes this migration, and this resulted from a delegation that was sent to him. The Aus and the Khazraj were two Yemeni tribes who had migrated many, many generations before to this city called Yathrib. It was an agricultural city, largely date palms. And they had battles amongst each other. They were constantly fighting. There was intertribal warfare. And they were really getting tired of it. And they wanted an end to this violence. There was a Jewish community living there. And they were tended to be traders, although some of them had date palms also. They controlled the marketplace in Medina. And they used to tell these Arabs about the final prophet, how he would show up, and he was going to show up in their city, and that he would remove all their idols, and that he would purify their land and bring the true teaching. Now, these Jews believed that it would be a Jewish prophet. So when the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam emerged, they said to each other, maybe this is the man that the Jews were talking about. So they wanted to go see for themselves, and when they did, they ended up becoming Muslim and submitting to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam's deen, and then the Prophet migrated to them, and these incredible bonds of brotherhood occurred between those who migrated and between the people of Medina. Now, the hijrah marks the first date. It begins year one for the Muslims. So in a sense, this is the beginning of real time for us, when Islam becomes successful, established in the earth. That is year one for the Muslims.